The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 337 for Monday, June 20th, 2011.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, you send in your tips, we try to answer your questions, we share your tips. We talk about all things Apple and Mac here in Durham, New Hampshire. I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
And here in Durham, New Hampshire, is Pilot Pete.
There he is.
There I be.
Yeah. So, you know, John, lately I've been, and I talked about this a little bit and promised we would talk about it more, so we are now. I've been using my iPhone more and more for GPS, for turn-by-turn directions.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't have a dedicated, I'll tell you, I have a rather dated, but it's a Garmin Nuvi. I believe it's a 360.
Yeah.
And it does just great. The only aggravation is that now it keeps pestering me every now and then for map updates because the maps are a couple of years old, but
right.
Yeah,
right.
My needs, they're accurate, but yes, of course, we know that the iPhone has a GPS and of course some, apps that can take advantage of that.
That's right. Yeah. And so we do have dedicated, we had a Garmin, an old Street Pilot, that we still have. And then of course, both of the vehicles that we own have their own in-dash GPS systems, but the one in our Toyota Sienna, we've had the vehicle 4 years and it's been trying to kill me for 4 years now. And I've pretty much given up on having the thing try to guide me anywhere because it's totally out to get me. In fact, it sucks.
Well, what do you mean? Does it tell you to take U-turns or drive into lakes because I've heard of people, unfortunately, not using discretion. I've read about this. Yeah. People taking U-turns or just listening to the device and trusting the machine, which I don't think you should ever trust the machine. Use a little judgment.
Well, this thing, it warns me too far in advance. It's like 2 miles in advance of a turn. It tells me, turn right in 2 miles. And then when you get to the turn, it says, and up on the right is Smith Street. Well, I freaking know Smith Street's up on the right. Do you want me to turn or not? You know, it's unclear. And it's bad news. So,
which one does this? Is it the in-car ones?
It's the in-car one in our Toyota Sienna, which is our minivan. So,
okay. Cause I gotta say the Garmin, at least mine, is very good about that.
That thing tried to make me do U-turns all the time too. I kind of hated our Garmin, for that.
But anyways, go.
Yeah.
iPhone options.
So I've been using and experimenting with a lot of different apps on the iPhone and I wasn't sure how to do this because I'd used a bunch of them. Really, forget all of them except the two that I'm going to tell you about here. The best one that I found on the iPhone is Navigon's Mobile Navigator. Now, you can get it at a couple of different price points. For $45, you get maps of USA and Canada. And that's the whole deal, right? I mean, that's what you need to get going. It loads the maps on them. You could turn your radios off on the device. Well, you'd still need the GPS radio on, but you don't need cell access necessarily. And you've got it on. And the other one I'm going to talk about has that too. So, the maps are loaded on the device. So $45 for USA and Canada, $35 for just the USA, but all of the USA, or $25 for just your region. And I think that's the East Coast, Central, or West Coast. So you can, do it whatever way you want. There are a couple of add-on options to it. You can get traffic data for $5. You can get speed cameras for $5 and Zagat for like $8 or something. And they've got a couple others like panoramic 3D view, which is kind of cool, but it's not necessary. So my feeling is if you're using GPS on a regular basis on your phone, this is the one to get. A couple of cool things that it does that none of the others that I've used do well. And number one is speed limits. It actually knows the speed limits on all the roads that you're on. And it's amazingly accurate. You drive by a speed limit sign when it changes and you can watch the thing change and you can have it warn you when you can pick, in town, I want you to tell me if I'm more than 5 miles over on the highway. I want you to tell me if I'm more than 10 miles over. Cause of course it knows your speed too, cause it's tracking you on GPS. So,
And then does it send a report so you get a ticket if you?
No.
Oh, that's good.
No. It keeps that to itself. And it'll also, you know, it's really smooth. The voices, it does text to speech, and it's really clear. I like it because the text to speech, I can pick a man's voice or a woman's voice. And I much prefer my GPS to have a woman's voice. It just works better for me. And so that's the one. If you're doing it every day, I like the Navigon, but it is relatively speaking expensive. Of course, it's not anywhere near as expensive as a standalone GPS unit that's worth its salt. But you know, as far as apps go, it's expensive. The other side of this, and this is why I said there's going to be two we're going to talk about, is Copilot Live USA. Copilot Live USA, $5. They have a North America version, which gets you USA and Canada for $20. The latter includes your text-to-speech as a standard option. The former one, the $5 one, you got to pay $3 to add text-to-speech. But here's the rub. The text-to-speech in that one is only a male voice. So it speaks street names and all that stuff, but it's not the female voice. And I'm not alone. Apparently, most people find that they will pay more attention to GPS directions from a female voice than from a male voice, which tends to get lost in the car. So
I think especially if you're male, because
that's not true. No, they say that the studies are that it's women as well. So, but you know, for $5, and I think everybody should do this, right? So if you're happy with whatever you're using, or you find you don't need it, then maybe Navigon's too much for you. Copilot for $5, buy it, install it on your phone. When you travel, you know, you rent a car somewhere, you're good to go. You know, you've got your directions right there. The maps are built in. They update them all the time. You know, both of these companies, they're updating them regularly, every couple of months or so. So you don't run into the problem that you have with a standalone unit where the maps get stale. You can, and each of these does this a little differently, but you can tell it, I don't want to go on this road. You can report map errors and it all works. The traffic data is kind of cool, although I'm really not necessarily sold on having the GPS route me around traffic. More often than not, I find it just, and this isn't the fault of the GPS, it's just how they all work. You know, if there's traffic one way, there's often traffic everywhere else that it's going to route you, and it may or may not know about that.
So, now, are these both purely software, or do they give you any, you know, a bracket?
Yeah, or, so you can get a mounting bracket. I have the one that's from Navigon, and I think it was like $30 or something like that. But I would highly recommend a bracket of some sort. I have one that just sticks to the windshield and then holds my iPhone in it. Which is great, not only for this, but you know, if you want to Skype with somebody or something while you're driving, of course you can do that too, right? Isn't that great? Isn't that smart? But here's the thing. So this morning, as I was kind of putting together the details of this, I saw that just late last week, Copilot, ALK, the company that owns Copilot, announced or sort of leaked some pictures of the next version of Copilot Live. And while they haven't released a feature list, by looking at the pictures, you can see that they've added a couple of things. Number one, they've added the speed limits, which they don't currently have in the U.S. They have them in other countries, but that looks like that's coming. They've also added text-to-speech with female voices. And they've also added something that Navigon makes that does really well currently. When you are coming on a highway and you want to take an exit, the Navigon screen totally changes, and they paint up on the screen the highway signs and tell you which lane to get in and go. And I mean, the signs will be customized to where you are and often look exactly like the signs that you see above you as you're driving on the road. It looks like Copilot's taking a page out of that book too, because some of those screenshots appear to do similar things. So, you know, that $5 for Copilot Live may actually wind up giving you more and more than it does right now. But those are the two. Navigon, definitely the best one that's out there right now. Copilot Live for $5. If you don't think you need it, get it, because you don't want to have to install it on the fly, because it's like a gig or whatever. It's more than a gig worth of data, because you're pulling down all that map data to your phone. But definitely worth it. So there's my roundup on GPS apps. Forget all the others. They might be, you know, maybe, you know, a little bit, you know, not quite as good, but it's just not worth it. I've tried a bunch of them. These are the two. So any thoughts, John?
My thoughts are I'm perfectly happy with my
With your Garmin. Of course you are.
With my Garmin, except for the pestering that the maps are out of date, which it does, you know, maybe once every couple of months. And I know this.
Right.
You know, stop bugging me. And I think, you know, if they just price it a little less. So I think I paid a couple hundred bucks for it. It's, you know, the screen is about the same size as the iPhone. But the problem is the updates, I think they're like, every now and then, like one time I got a special offer. I think it was from Amazon because I bought it through them. And they're like, hey, we got a special $50 for the map update. And I'm like,
yep.
You know,
see, I paid,
the thing is I paid, you know, maybe $200 for it. So is $50 just to update the map worth it? Or do I just buy another one that has way more features like widescreen and stuff? And
or buy, to me, it doesn't make, buy the app for your iPhone and forget about it. You're done.
I would not be comfortable using my iPhone as a GPS.
Wait, why?
I'm just afraid that it's going to take a spill and get destroyed, man.
Wow, if you mount it on a little bracket and plug it in, there's no problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're misguided on that one. It's the best GPS experience I've ever had is on the iPhone. And I have to say, Copilot's user interface is quirky. GPS app user interfaces are quirky anyway. Copilot's is quirkier than Navigon's. I found Navigon's easier to navigate, so no surprise. But of course, Navigon was just purchased by Garmin, so let's hope Garmin doesn't screw it up.
Gets rid of all the good features.
Yeah, let's hope not, because their user interfaces are wacky too.
Always so. The way.
Well, you know, upon careful consideration, I think you're right, Dave. I'm misguided.
I think so.
I always listen to you.
I know. Wow.
Except when I don't.
Except of course when you don't. That's right.
I was going to say that was too easy.
All right. Our first sponsor for this show is Circus Ponies with Notebook. Notebook for both the Mac and the iPad. The idea here is you start with a white lined piece of paper virtually on your Mac or your iPad. You can plug in. You can pull in other data from PDFs or pictures or whatever and put them right in there. But you can also just type right into this notebook, builds a little tabbed hierarchical view, create different pages. And really, it's built to assemble data for projects or events or something that you've got going on, maybe a class that you're taking or a new initiative at work, something where you want to kind of assemble all this data together, build an outline of notes, multiple pages. You can pull in audio files too. In fact, some people listen to Mac Geek Gab. They pull in the MP3 of the show and then paste in the links from the show notes and then go through and make notes about each thing that we discuss, maybe what they want to do or something we mentioned. And then they've got one notebook per each episode and can actually go back and refer to it. It's very, very cool stuff. And of course, you can do this on the iPad too and sync back and forth between them. Very, very cool stuff. Notebook for the Mac is available at circusponies.com. It's $49 or $49.95, so a nickel short of $50. Unless you're a student or somehow otherwise affiliated with the school, and then it's a nickel short of $30, $29.95. But of course, you can get a free trial, and that's how I recommend you start. Go to circusponies.com, download the free trial, and try it out there. And then, of course, the iPad version is a penny short of $30, because that's how Apple does their pricing at the App Store. So it's $29.99. There is no free trial of that because of the way that works, but try it out on your Mac first. Play around with it there. Get hooked and then go for it and buy the one on the Mac and then on the iPad. And Pete, I know you use Notebook. I do.
Cool feature of the week for Notebook is links. You can create links from any one page in a notebook to another page in the notebook. For instance, I have
table of contents style.
I have, for instance, on my to-do page, I'll have phone calls that I need to make. And then once I'm done with them, I'll check it off. But next to that name, I now have a link that takes me back to a page later in the notebook where I have notes from that phone conversation that we had.
Now, can you tag those notes and move things around
absolutely.
And all that stuff? Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. But having links, being able to go, what page it was back there somewhere. Where exactly was it? I know I called this guy. Here it is on my to-do list. There's a link next to his name. Boom. And there are the notes from our phone conversation. Yeah.
Wow, that adds like a whole other use case to
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. You can link all kinds of things throughout the notebook back and forth to each other so you aren't lost looking for. Because my notebook now is really big and it could get really convoluted because I've got different projects going on. And of course I have tabs for each of those projects, but some of the my pages are like, I have safety reports that are 150, 200 pages deep right now. Wow. And to find each of those is more difficult than to just have a link going, all right, I know it's in one of the safety reports. I don't have to even go to the page table of contents and start reading down 150 items looking for it. Huh. I could either go a keyword search would be a quick way to do it. But if I know I've got a link based on a conversation I had with somebody about a safety report, it takes me right to it.
Cool. All right. Notebook at circusponies.com. Now let's dive into some follow-ups from some previous shows, which actually are standalone questions in their own right. So we'll let Connor take it away.
Hello, John and Dave. This is Connor P. On MackeyCap 334, which I believe is the most recent one, you were having a discussion about application installers that required you to either restart or log out, and it had to do with whether it changed user level settings or system level settings or how far it stuck its fingers into the operating system. But at least for me, when I have to log out, that's pretty much the worst part of having to restart. So by the time I've had to log out and log back in, I might as well just restart my computer just to get everything nice and fresh again. Because for me, the restart process is not the painful part. The painful part is reopening all of my applications and all my documents and moving all my windows around and all that stuff. So I guess my question is, why even bother just having the logout option? Because at least for me, I don't really see the pain of restarting the rest of the way once you've already logged out.
Got it. Yeah. So you make a good point. If you're the only user logged in, then there's really not much of a cost there. But in a situation where you've got a computer in the house where you might have accounts for it, and I live this way, where you've got accounts for each of your kids and all of that stuff, that's a huge thing. You know, it's not just as simple as clicking restart. I've got to go and log into each of those accounts. If I've got, you know, what is it called? Multiple logins set up, and I've got to go into each of those accounts for the kids or for my wife and quit out of everything that they have and save it and then log them out so that their data isn't just, you know, summarily booted when I click the button. So that can actually be a very painful process, far worse than having to just log out of mine, because if I'm doing an installer from my account, I can hit restart and it will close all my apps and offer to have me save things and all of that stuff, whereas it won't for the rest of them. So that's really the user experience difference between the two from my standpoint. So John, you got any thoughts on this?
Well, I think we touched on it before, but the thing is, a lot of this is, well, if you use Package Maker, which is Apple's creator of install packages, which we'll be talking about again in a moment, but the developer dictates what should happen. And we touched on it before, I'll touch on it again here, is that it's actually something that they can make a conscious decision to require the user to do, whether
right.
it be, and it's actually in the package, it's under a configuration tab. If you don't have this, get the developer tools. You know, if you have a developer account, you can get them for free. Otherwise, I think you can buy them for $5 through the App Store. But under the configuration tab for a portion of the installer package, there is a restart action. Now, the developer can decide what to do there. They can say nothing, require logout, require restart, or if you're hardcore, require shutdown. And hopefully that's based on the requirements of whatever the heck they're installing.
Right.
And it makes sense. I mean, the best thing, you know, I got to say, I get nervous sometimes where it says just do a logout and not a restart.
If you're installing just into your user account, then that's, I mean, that's fine. If it's just a user level app and when you log out, it's going to quit and then relaunch.
Sure.
You're fine. Yeah. Default folder is like that. You know, if I.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. It just makes me nervous sometimes. You know, are they getting it right? Are there going to be any right. potential gotchas if you just do a logout? Because a restart, based on what I know, reloads more than just a logout.
Oh, absolutely.
Like you were absolutely. Saying, yeah. So rather than user level stuff, it's system level stuff. So, yeah, it's a pain in the neck. And yes, it can be slow. And I think I saw Pete was saying, you know, get an SSD, man.
Yeah. All right. So you mentioned package files. Gabe, take it away.
Hey, John, Dave, and Pilot Pete. This is Pete from Wisconsin. Been a while. I haven't been able to listen to many podcasts lately. Work has been absolutely crazy, but finally catching up on them. Currently listening to MacGeek 333. Yeah, I know that one's fairly old, but still, it's been crazy here for a few weeks. Listening about, let me look at the chapter here, about what constitutes a safe file. Jeff, I think is the name here. You and or Dave and John were speculating on what Mac Defender, Mac Protector, Mac Security, whatever it's called at the present time, is downloaded as. And yes, it is downloaded as a zip file. When it's unzipped, it produces a .mpg file. I've had a couple of dealings with it on other people's computers. One of them was actually pretty insistent on it. There were 8 instances of both the zip file and the M package file. If you could just shed some light on what an M package file is versus just a straight package file, I'm really not sure what the difference between it is, other than an extra letter. Great podcast. Love the advice. Really saved my bacon in the past. Hope you guys have a great week. And
thanks, Gabe. Okay, so I think you missed a letter when you were saying it, Gabe. It's .mpkg files versus .pkg. And like you said, it's just got an extra letter. MPKG is a meta package. The PKG uses the systems installer. A meta package is totally self-contained, meaning it's bypassing the systems installer. That's my understanding of how those things work. Do you know differently, John?
Yes, I do.
Oh, well, then go.
Would you like me to tell you?
Yeah, go.
Well, you're right. MPKG is a meta install package.
Okay.
Now you may be asking, what is a meta install? What could that possibly be? And, well, the meta kind of clues you in. If you open up an MPKG file, you know what you're going to see inside of that, Dave?
What's that?
Multiple PKG files.
Okay, so it doesn't bypass the installer, but it just has multiple installation packages inside it.
Right, and I'll give you an example. I'll give you a very quick example. Now, how did I determine this? Well, it's fairly easy. If you click on an MPKG or a PKG file, and you say show package contents, you can dig inside. Now, a PKG file, what it's typically going to contain is a gzipped archive, among other things, but that's mainly what's in there, along with a lot of other stuff, but right. That's the key feature. But if you say show package contents on an MPKG file, it will, at some level, show you multiple PKG files. Now, why would you want to do this? Well, I found one example, which I think is a good example of why you may want to do this. And let me see.
I've got an example. Apple's installers do this, right?
Oh, well, absolutely. Yes, right. Yes, yeah. Oh, well, the OS installer, no question.
Right, because you've got all these tiny little packages and they bundle them together into a meta package file. And then that way you can pick and choose which ones you want to go fire off. And from a maintenance standpoint, for Apple's standpoint, you know, or any developer's standpoint, it's much simpler to maintain each one of those packages individually. If you need to change something in one, you don't have to go and reconfigure the whole shooting match or worry that you're impacting something else because they're all sort of standalone package installers.
So, correct.
Yeah.
And one that I stumbled across. So that's a great example. And something that helps you peek into these files is something we'll mention before. And I'll mention it again is Pacifist.
Right.
Let's you. But I looked at one, Dave, and to me, it opened my eyes. In addition to your fine example, it opened my eyes to why you'd want to do this. So I looked inside the Flip for Mac WMV MPKG file.
Okay.
For people that don't know about this, Flip for Mac is something.
Was doesn't exist. Oh, Flip for Mac. I'm thinking of the Flip camera.
No.
Sorry, I'm heading down the wrong path. Flip for Mac is a good thing. Go.
It's okay. No, yeah. Flip for Mac. So Microsoft decided to abandon development of the Windows Media Player for the Mac platform. But what they did is suggested that people use this thing called Flip for Mac WMV, which basically lets you do the same thing. And I looked in that file, and what did I find when I looked in the MPKG? Not one, not two, but 3 PKG files. So within it, in the resources, so contents resources, there's Flip for Mac QuickTime components. Okay, that's good. Flip for Mac web plugins. Okay, that's nice too. And Silverlight, which is Microsoft's. So they have those 3 PKG files are embedded in the Flip for Mac WMV MPKG file.
Got it.
So It's not just a letter, and it makes sense, as you said, Dave, either for a system installer, which is a compilation of, you know, hundreds of these PKG files, I believe, or something like for Mac. So it shouldn't matter to the user. I mean, it should be transparent to you. You may or may not see the launching of multiple installers. You may not, depending on how they architect it. So
cool. All right. Again, back in 333, and I'm glad Pete's here. Michael writes, listening to 333, and I heard how Pilot Pete saved 30 gigs by deleting old backups of his mobile devices. He explained how to find them in the Finder. While he's right that there is that's where they're stored, there is an easier way to delete these old backups. Inside iTunes, go to Preferences and go to Devices. And in there, you'll see the latest backup of your iOS devices and possibly older backups. You'll know which is the newest to oldest because the backups are dated. Just do a simple highlight and click the delete button. And Michael, you're right. Thank you for this, because, I went and did this on a couple of my machines and I found backups of older, you know, I retired an iPhone or retired an iPod and I got a new iPad. And all of that stuff, you know, the old versions of it were sitting out there taking up space. So this is a handy way to find it.
Yeah, what's the fun of that, though? We're using a GUI when you can dig down in the Finder. I mean, well, I should have given him a terminal command to get rid of.
If you want to dig down in the Finder, Craig actually has a question and we'll give him an answer.
Hi, John, Dave, and Pilot Pete. I was just listening to episode 333. And Pilot Pete gave his tip about claiming some disk space back and deleting your old iPod and backups, etc. And he gave the path, which was library, application support, mobile sync, backup. But in there, how do you know which folder is associated with which device? I mean, I'm looking at mine now and it's like many, many characters of all jumbled up letters. I mean, I know I could go into iTunes and delete the backups that way, but I was just wondering how you'd know which number corresponds to which device. Okay, thanks for your help. This way you can cut me off.
All right, Craig. So, John, this is an interesting one because it does look like a lot of gobbledygook out there. But what it is it is the UDID, which is a unique identifier for your device. And that creates, iTunes creates a folder in that mobile backups folder with your UDID. That way, if you change the name of the device or whatever, it doesn't matter. The UDID will never change. It's also why even if you clone your old device to a new one, you still wind up with an old backup that sits out there because the UDID has changed. You can find the UDID if your device is connected in iTunes and you click on the device. And then on the first info tab, you will see... gosh, somebody help me with this here. I don't have a device connected to iTunes in front of me, but there is a way. In fact, there's probably a knowledge base article out there. But yeah, you click somewhere, right? I think on the version number of the software, and that will tell you the UDID.
Here, sorry, the one day I didn't bring a cord. I could do that.
Yeah, that's right. To find your phone's UDID, plug it into your computer, wait till iTunes, come to the summary tab, click the word serial number beside the picture of the phone, and it will change from the serial number to the identifier. And it's a big, long string. Really, all you need to do is pay attention to the first maybe five or six characters, and that's going to be unique enough on your system to find, you know, one or two of these older things that are out there.
That's far too organized. Here's how I did it. Nuke and pave. No, in all seriousness, I just used the date of the backups, and I had a backup that was 2.5 years old. I went, yeah, I don't need that anymore.
I was going to mention that, but you touched on it, Pete. Yeah. Is the date of that file with the incomprehensible UD, whatever the heck it is, will match what you see in the iTunes backup list. That's the only way I figured it out as well. Yeah. Now, if the dates are all the same, well, then you got a little problem. And yeah, then you'll have to scrounge to find this this value.
But, and then your other option is you really could nuke and pave as long as your devices are all in good shape. You could nuke.
What's the point of a backup if you're going to nuke it?
Well, then you turn around and back up again. And now you've got one good backup of the device that you have in hand. And that's the one you want to
keep. Need.
And I did that with my iPad. I deleted all the iPad ones and put a fresh one on.
There you go. A quick follow up. We talked last time. My son had that cracked iPod Touch that clearly was accidental damage. He actually dropped the charger, the Apple charger, right onto the iPod Touch and hit it right right where the glass stops around the home button.
I think that's a design flaw.
Yeah. Yeah, well, but here's the cool thing, and I asked
in the
on
charger.
I asked
and the,
on,
and yeah, the charger's the charger. too heavy.
Yeah.
So we went to the Apple store, and sure enough, you know, we told them, here's what happened, and you know, we were totally honest with them, and the guy said, let me check something. He looked in the system, and he came back, and he said, yep, we're going to go ahead and swap that out for you. And I said, really? I said thanks. He said, yeah, it's fine. He said, normally we don't cover accidental damage, but we have the option of looking the other way once per device or per purchase. I mean, obviously now, even though they just swapped it out. So he has a new device, but if he were to break this one, you know, it's all considered the same purchase, which it is. Otherwise, it would have been $149 for an iPod Touch 4G. They call it a flat rate repair, and anything you do to it, they'll swap it out. Now, presumably their look the other way once thing only happens if it's still under warranty of any kind, which of course his is, because he only got it back in December. So that was good news. It was, so I wanted to share that it seems as though this is a unpublished policy. It's a written policy, but not published, and seems to apply to anything, iPhones and the above. So.
Yeah. You know, in the event you're not covered though, I mean, I have AppleCare on, obviously on my laptop, yeah, and such, but I found on the mobile devices like my iPhone and my iPad, I go to somebody else who does cover,
yeah,
damage. And I don't know if you want me to mention them or not.
You can mention Square Trade.
Yeah, it's Square Trade. Okay. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, I use Square Trade
warranties.
I have Square Trade on mine too. It's yeah.
So they cover. It's a $50 deductible if you have accidental damage, which, you know, it's fair. Otherwise, you just smack your device and go, "Hey, I want a new one." But yeah,
that's right.
I'm gonna mention something else, just out of the blue. Well, there's another option here. So you mentioned, Dave, the price. So Apple's sticker price for doing that, for replacing the glass, is how much?
$149.
Okay. One place.
But, yeah. It replaces every. It's the flat rate repair. So, I mean, it would have been.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. All I'll say is that another option. I don't have a lot of feedback from people. I have some data points, but iRescue, and I'm just looking right now.
Yeah, iRescue.
So they have iPod Touch Gen 4, and I'm just looking right now. So iPod Touch Gen 4, broken glass, LCD, and digitizer repair replacement, $105.
Okay, so with shipping.
If you're out of warranty, or if they tell you, sorry, I think iRescue is worth exploring.
Yeah,
IRESQ.
I prefer Tech Restore over iRescue, but only only because I've used them and I know them. But I don't have any reason not to. You know, it's a preference. Not I'm not staying away from iRescue.
I used iRescue. It was a long time ago, but my Thai book. Remember that far back? But I had problems with that, and and I think they also. I don't know if they still. You know, if the machine's totally dead, I think they'll give you. You know, some money for you know, rooting the components out of it.
Right. That's true.
I don't know if they do that anymore.
No,
but,
I think
but
they
did. They did when I had it. You know, I had it repaired, and then, you know, a little while, you know, a couple of years later, it totally failed. And like, well, you know, we'll give you something, because, you know, that's how they operate. I think they scavenge parts from machines, and assuming they're in good shape, they'll repurpose them. So
that's right. Yeah. So, yeah, I looked at that. And I saw that iRescue was, $105. Now with shipping, you know, you're getting pretty close to the 150, and the same with Tech Restore was actually a little more expensive. They were, I think, 130 or something. And then again, shipping, you're getting right up next to it. But I figured if we had to pay to replace it, I was going to pay Apple to do it, A, because they would do it right there on the spot. Mm-hmm. And then B, you know, it's still in Apple's system, and we do have some warranty left on the, you know, on the original purchase. And I thought that might not be a bad idea, but yeah, if you're out of warranty, Tech Restore, iRescue, those are the only two places I would go.
Well, I think they're also, I mean, they probably have a pretty hefty file, not only on you, Dave, but on your son. And I think they're looking down the road here and thinking that, you know, he's probably going to remember this someday.
That's right. Oh yeah.
Think favorably, and who knows, he may grow up to be, you know, run a media empire like you. So
that's right. Yeah. That's right.
So they figure, you know, if we start them early, just like Apple did with the Apple II, if we start the kids early and treat them good, then they'll repay us.
I think that's exactly. No, I mean, I don't think that's a specific case, but I think that's their general customer service strategy is keep people happy and they'll keep coming back. So I was going to read Chadwick's email, but I can paraphrase a little bit. I ranted a little bit because last week about the whole Quicken
yes,
and Lion thing. Well, I have to eat a little bit of crow.
We didn't know where they stood.
Well,
you know, they're leaving people hanging, right?
Yeah, they still are. But I complained that, you know, I contacted someone at Intuit and they shuffled me off on the PR agency. Well, the PR agency worked very hard and did their job. I actually spent some time on the phone with Aaron Paltzer last Thursday. Aaron was the original founder of Mint.com, which was acquired by Intuit about a year and a half ago. And now Aaron is the VP in charge of the whole consumer products at Intuit. So essentially Quicken and Mint and all of the various stuff. The net is Quicken will not work with Lion out of the gate. And it's because of the fact that Lion does not have Rosetta. So Lion can't run PowerPC code. Aaron explained to me that the Quicken code base goes back to, you know, the early 90s at the very least, and possibly even the late 80s. They actually built their own database engine for that because, you know, standard database engines didn't exist. And so there's nothing on the Intel side that can even read that database, let alone, manipulate the data. So that's why a number of years ago, they decided to rebuild from the ground up with Quicken Essentials. Now, Quicken Essentials sucked when it came out. It couldn't even import, you know, my whatever it was, 10, 15 years worth of data. And a lot of other people had the same problem. It would crash in the middle. Apparently I'd written it off. I honestly haven't touched it since then. And you know, it's personal finance software. So if it's going to crash on me, I'm going to experience what I'll call an emotional detachment from that. And I'm not saying that I'm emotionally detached. This is a detachment that happens emotionally, right? So it's an emotional detachment from it. But from some people I've talked to, including Aaron, but certainly some neutral third parties, they say that it's better. So I'm going to check that out. But two other pieces of software that came up are actually three. One is iBank from Ig Software, I think. The other is MoneyDance at MoneyDance.com. The third is Jumsoft's Money, which they have a version 3 out and they're coming out with version 4. Seems like iBank might be the leader of the pack there. But Intuit is working with Apple's Rosetta libraries. Apple let them play with these Rosetta libraries, and basically, you know, from to paraphrase, said, go play. If you can make it work, have fun. But we're not going to bake that into Lion. And they've been working for about 2 or 3 months. It's not an easy process. It's not as simple as Apple just decided to take Rosetta out of Lion. I think there were reasons for this. And Intuit's giving it another 3 months. They said end of the summer. So by the end of the summer, which is going to be after Lion is out, they will either have a solution for us to run Quicken 2007 inside Lion, or it will be a dead project and it will never happen. And that's according to Aaron Paltzer last week. So a little bit of crow because I complained about the way Intuit initially handled it, but actually they handled it really well. But they still are leaving us out in the lurch with 2007. But if Quicken Essentials works for you, that's their option of doing it. And Pete, I misspoke last week too. I said you were using Quicken for Windows. You've moved to iBank.
Yeah. I was at the beginning of the year. I switched over to iBank. It's because it was nuts having to boot up parallels in both the iMac and and my personal laptop every time I wanted to run any of that. And it's actually worked out quite well. And we had a conversation, obviously, off the air about it. And I was telling you how much I liked it. The reason I switched at the beginning of the year is for year-end tax purposes. It just made it easier to go and track all my finances for tax preparation in one file instead of two. But one of the questions you asked me was, is there an update, a single-point update? And in iBank, there is. Click download, and it goes. It'll get all your finances and all that stuff to import transactions. Yeah. And at the time, I was unaware of. I had forgotten it. I knew it was there, and I had forgotten it.
Yeah.
But I am really enjoying iBank. There's a little bit of a learning curve on it.
It's not the same UI as Quicken, is it?
No, not at all. Yeah. Not at all.
That's the only complaint I've heard from people is that if you don't expect to just walk into it and be happy.
Right. There's just a couple things. You know, for instance, when you go to reconcile an account, you have to create a statement. And it does a nice job of working it for you. But But once you get to zero, that balance is zeroed out, it'll close out on you. And you have to go back and manually say, no, I want to make an edit somewhere in there, that sort of thing. And
okay.
Which is just not intuitive.
Sure. Especially coming from Quicken.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Intuit and Quicken. Yeah, I get it. But I really like iBank. I've been using it 6 months solidly now, and it does a really nice job of importing from any bank. If you don't happen to have a bank that it is natively supported, it creates a browser window and you can go get stuff and it imports it. And yeah,
cool.
It'll choose things you can override to not bring things in.
Right. Right. Cool. All right. We've got some new questions to talk about. First, I want to mention our second sponsor for this show, which is the newest sponsor this month, which is Drobo Data Robotics. The Drobo is, they call it plug-in peace of mind for your digital life. Now, for those of you that don't know, the Drobo is it's a standalone unit that you plug SATA hard drives, S-A-T-A hard drives into. And it appears to your Mac or your Windows machine or whatever you connect to it as one single device, unless you configure it differently. But for most home users, that's going to be one single device. The cool part is that it never gets full because you can keep adding hard drives to it. And if you fill up all the bays, depending on which Drobo you get, for most of our listeners here, I think either the regular Drobo or the Drobo FS would be the right one. The regular Drobo has 4 bays. The Drobo FS has 5. And you can take out one of the drives and put in a new one, and the space just grows. It's magic. You don't lose data. It just simply works. It takes the whole concept of RAID and goes beyond that. They have support for Apple's Time Machine, so you can set your Drobo as a backup volume. And the cool part is, just like when you take a drive out, the Drobo, doesn't lose data. Well, if a drive dies, it also doesn't lose data, right? You just take the drive out, you replace it, and all your data stays there. So it's got some, I was going to say it has some fault tolerance. It has a lot of fault tolerance built in. The Drobo FS is cool because it sits alone on the network. It's got a gigabit Ethernet port, and you just plug into it, and all the devices on that network can see it. The regular Drobo has it's got USB and FireWire ports and eSATA ports that you can plug into, and that then your Mac just sees as a regular hard drive. On the Drobo FS, you can set up a separate Time Machine partition that will limit the amount of space that Time Machine takes up. As we all know, Time Machine will take up eventually as much space as you have. And that may not be how you want to allocate a device like the Drobo, which of course effectively has, more storage than you would ever need. You don't want Time Machine to just grow and grow. So the Drobo FS actually has a way of limiting that, and it works really, really well. You can, of course, check all this out at Drobo.com. We'll be talking more and more about this. But I encourage you to check it out. I've got one here. I've been using a Drobo for many years. Very happy to have them on board as a sponsor because it's easy to talk about because I love the thing. I couldn't possibly live without it. For me, I store a bunch of kind of random files, large files, and then I also store our entire movie and my entire music library out on the Drobo. And I know that my data is safe, and I also know that I don't need to worry about filling up a hard drive with it because I can just add more storage without having to copy data around. The Drobo takes care of it. So all of this at Drobo.com.
I've got two.
You've got two. Yeah, I've got two downstairs too. That's right. Yeah.
It's awesome. I mirrored my Drobos.
Speaking of Time Machine, Robert asks, in March, I started to use my Time Capsule to back up my 6-month-old 17-inch MacBook Pro, as well as my early 2008 iMac, which I've been backing up this way from new. The MacBook Pro seems to back up regularly when it is on and connected to my network, but my iMac has started showing the following error message periodically, usually when I have been away from the computer for a couple of hours or so and it has gone into sleep mode. It says Time Machine could not complete the backup. The network backup disk could not be accessed because there was a problem with the network username or password. What is odd about that is a Time Machine backup often seems to start whilst the message is showing and without any intervention from me. So the username and password must be okay in my keychain. There's still plenty of free space on the time capsule. I keep both Mac's OS's up to date. This never occurred when I was only backing up the iMac and is really not any great problem since backups seem to happen regularly when I'm actually working on the iMac. I've looked on the Apple site for help, but I've not been able to locate any information about this particular problem. I wonder if you can shed any light on the possible cause. John?
Yes.
I think you have an answer for Robert.
I have a speculation. I don't know if it's an answer.
Fair
enough.
So
number one, thank goodness that he sent screenshots, because I had not seen this specific one from Time Machine, right. But he did send us a Get Info window from the Time Machine backup volume. And here's the thing that jumped out at me, Dave.
Yes.
With all the info, so of course he has plenty of space, but looking at all the info here, it said format Mac OS extended paren case dash sensitive comma journaled close paren.
Interesting.
That struck me as somewhat unusual. Now, on the one hand,
because case sensitive is not how Mac OS X formats drives by default.
Correct. On the other hand, I did search, and I'm not sure if I have it handy, but I did find a support article, because you know I'm all about Apple support articles.
You are.
And I think they actually have one. It's called Time Machine 101. And it's part of a very nice series of tutorials that they have. And they do, at least in this article, now maybe it's dated, I don't know, but they explicitly say, you know, if you really want to, you can format a Mac a Time Machine backup as Mac OS extended case sensitive. I don't know about you, Dave, but I don't have any drives formatted as Mac OS extended case sensitive journaled. I certainly have. And all my Time Machine volumes are Mac OS extended journaled without the case sensitive. So just because that jumped out at me is the only difference between my setup and his.
Actually, your setup is the same as his. And I'm going to explain why.
Really?
Yeah. I'm just looking at this now. So he has a time capsule, right? Which means that in theory, this Time Machine backups volume was created by Time Machine and should have been created the way Time Machine wanted it created. So what I did was I just mounted my time capsule. And in there, of course, are sparse bundles for each computer that backs up to it. So I opened up one of the sparse bundles and it mounts a drive called Time Machine Backups. And if I do get info on that drive, which is a virtual disk because it's just a bundle, so it's a disk image, it comes up as Mac OS extended case sensitive journaled. So that part of things is actually operating just the same way I see them here. And my guess is if you're going through the process on your end, John, you're going to see the same thing. It seems like Time Machine does create case sensitive journaled volumes when it creates these. Because I didn't
all
do anything
I know
special
is, well,
mine.
I'm just looking right now on my Mini with my external volume that is set up as a Time Machine. Now, it's not a time capsule. It's
right,
Time
that's,
Machine.
That's the because you don't have a sparse bundle on there. Right. It's just
but it is Mac
data.
OS extended journaled. And actually, I'm looking on my MacBook Pro to confirm what you said. But it just jumped out at me as something that looked.
I think I might have an answer. Right. It says that it couldn't log in. Now, the time capsule actually doesn't have a username, to my knowledge, just a password for backups. But if he has two Macs, it's possible you have a Mobile Me account, and it's possible you're syncing keychains between the two. What that means, and I've seen this on my computers from time to time, is while the sync process is happening, the keychain is occasionally, the system complains that it's unavailable. Now I just click through it and it's fine. Similar behavior to what he's seeing here with his Time Machine thing. By the time he sees the error, often the backup has actually restarted and things are fine. So it's possible that a keychain sync operation is happening at exactly the moment that your backup is starting, and that could be it. And if it is, then it's nothing to worry about because the sync obviously finishes and everything's good. So yeah, that's interesting. I wonder why they do that. I wonder why they make it case sensitive.
No, that's weird. No, I confirm what you said. I mounted my sparse bundle and it is case sensitive, though I don't get the same icon that he gets.
Really?
Well, no, he gets when he did a Get Info, he gets the drive with the little clock and the arrow. I don't, at least in my MacBook Pro, when I launch my when I mount my time capsule or mounts the. But no, you're correct. It is sparse. So okay, he did write back and said he'd try another drive that's formatted as.
I know why you have a different. The icon he shows has the little time machine icon on it. When you mount it manually, you don't get that icon. But when it's mounted automatically by the system to start doing a backup, you get that icon. And that's presumably to give you a visual cue that this drive is, you know, special. So, yeah.
So in that case, my initial guess was misguided.
Wrong.
Misguided. Well, that's twice.
That's all right. You caught you picked me up on one. I pick you up on one here. This is how we work together.
But no, I learned something. I didn't know. I don't know why they're making it case sensitive.
The only reason
that's
I can
the format
think,
of the sparse bundle.
The only reason I can are, think hmm. is so that it doesn't have to look at the drive that it's backing up initially to decide how to format this, right? Because let's say, for example, you format your main boot drive comes from the factory formatted non-case sensitive to a case insensitive journaled. And then you down the road have some external drive that you add to your system and you decide to format that case sensitive. Now your backups will still be backed up case sensitive because your time machine is seeing things that way no matter what. And that may be the reason for this, is so that it can be sure to restore, and it's future proofing essentially at that point. Right.
So, all right. Now, you know, I've seen something similar. Yeah. But I've seen something similar, and I'll just mention it quickly and then we'll move on here. But I've seen something similar, which hints at a timing issue, is that sometimes when I start up my MacBook Pro, now, of course, I have its connection to the time capsule or, you know, the wireless connection is set up to automatically log in. And frequently, the OS will come up and say, "Oh, I can't find your default network. Here's a list of other ones. What do you want to do?" And then I'll look in the menu bar and I'll see that it's logged in. So it's almost like one part of the OS is like, "Oh, I give up. I can't find the base station." But another part is like, "No, I'm cool, man."
I've seen that happen.
And I don't know. And it doesn't make sense to me. I mean, if it says I can't log into the wireless network, but it does, I mean... Yeah, is some pref file screwed up or what? Because there's no way for me to, change the timing of how long it should try to do that before that dialogue comes up. And this also, I think, as you're suggesting, Dave, is maybe a timing thing. Is right. While it's trying to submit the credentials to log into the drive, something is happening. I don't know if he's. I mean, there has to be a time machine pref file. Maybe whacking that would be another.
Right. Yeah.
No, that's a yeah. No, I'm with you. I'm going to back off on the format thing. It's a obscure timing thing, which I hate this stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Happen. Yeah. Yeah. That's tough stuff to troubleshoot because, you know, you can look in the console logs and all that, but you've got to really look at everything that's happening and relate to otherwise unrelated, you know, things that are going on. So that can be can be wonky. So, all right, John, give me the name of the person whose question we're doing next.
What?
Give me the name of the of the person. Pick one. There's a whole laundry list.
All right.
Here.
So we did Robert. Let's see.
Pick your favorite because we're running short on time. This may be the last question before cool
John's going to play.
Well, favorites. I like. I'm going to go between. Let's try to get two in here. So I like Joel and I like John.
All right. Pick one. We'll see.
John's is quick.
John's is quick. So we'll do Joel and then John. That's fine. Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
So Joel writes, I think Joel writes, Joel wrote, he did write, he didn't call, he wrote, Joel writes, "I have a mid 2000 MacBook that needs a logic board replacement. I plan to send it through Apple for flat rate repair service, which on this machine is $280. My question is about security of the data. Should I be concerned, John?"
I would say yes. Not because I don't trust the people in the depot or along the path, but I would say just as good general practice. So two things. One, whenever I've shipped a machine in, number one, I've always either put in a different drive and or advice number one, backup the drive. Okay. Right. Backup all the data, use Karma Copy Cloner, Super Duper, whatever your favorite backup utility. Backup the drive. I would suggest formatting it with a fresh copy of the OS for two reasons. One, because you're going to erase or erase, you know, for where most people can't retrieve it, erase your data. But number two, you may be able to solve your problem with a fresh OS install. Who the heck knows? So, but I would say you never know. I mean, once it leaves your hands, I'm not going to say that. I'm not implying that Apple employees are untrustworthy and they're going to be, you know, fishing for your data. But the thing goes through many hands between you and getting to the depot, and it could fall into the wrong hands. Who knows?
Right.
And whether intentionally or unintentionally.
You're probably going to give it to FedEx, and who knows what's going to happen with it
In this case.
Well, I'd be more worried about UPS or USPS than FedEx. But
right answer.
Any DHL. Of them. Any of them. But yeah, once it leaves your hands, you never know. It could fall off the truck. It could get lost. It could get... So I would say, number one, make a backup. Number two, I think a fresh install is always good. Because a lot of times when I've shipped it in, they've asked, well, by the way, can you give me the username and password so I can log in and try to help diagnose the problem? And right. At that point, they have access to your data anyway. So...
Yep.
Back up your data. Do not. I would not recommend shipping it verbatim as you know, shutting it off and just putting it in a box and shipping it to them. I would make a backup and I would erase and reinstall a fresh OS on the drive. That's my recommendation. I don't know about you, Dave.
Yeah, it's a good recommendation. It's probably the same advice that I would give. But this is one of those situations where I don't actually follow my own advice. And longtime listeners of the show will know that I am guilty of this. And it's in sync with my whole attitude towards security, right? You know, I don't believe in, I don't know. I just, security is a balance between security and convenience, right? And
yeah. It's easy to throw it in a box and ship it off. Bingo. And then you're done.
And I almost always err on the side of convenience. Now I will shoot a backup because I know that I'm shipping it off. And right. I may never see it again. I mean, it may simply get lost or destroyed between my putting it in the box and it getting out to the driveway. Anything could happen. So having a backup is paramount. There is no convenience in not having a backup. But going through the process of, you know, wiping the drive and all that. Yeah, it's a great idea. I've never done it. Anything that needs to be that secure is actually encrypted on my computer somewhere, but there frankly isn't that much data that's that way. So, it is what it is, but yeah, it's good advice. All right. John asks, I'm currently running Mac OS X version 10.5.8 on my iMac 2.8 gigahertz Intel Core 2 Duo. I am interested in upgrading to Lion 10.7. However, I read where I must have Snow Leopard installed before I can install Lion. Is this true? I really don't want to have to purchase Snow Leopard just so I can install Lion. Well, the ESNES, if there's a workaround for the problem, I don't know.
No. It's easy. Uh-huh. I've got an easy answer, Dave.
Okay.
I mean, it's right on apple.com/macOS 10/how-2-buy. Step one, make sure your Mac can run Lion. Step two, make sure you have the latest version of Snow Leopard. Step three, download OS 10 Lion from the Mac App Store. To me, open and shut. Those are the three steps that Apple says you must follow. So to me, the answer is yes.
Yeah. And that,
it's a pain in the neck.
Right. And that's the problem, because you can't get to the Mac App Store with Leopard. You need Snow Leopard to access the Mac App Store. So I haven't tried this, but from what I understand, I think the Lion installers that have been given to developers so far, I think they will work A as a standalone and B as an install on top of prior versions, OS versions prior to Snow Leopard, but you can't get it. You need the Mac App Store to pull down that installer file. So I guess if you have another Mac or another way to get it, and then you can put it on maybe a thumb drive or something along those lines, it might work, but the trick is going to be getting it. It's a chicken and egg kind of thing going on there. So
Between me and you, Dave, a little birdie told me that the latest DP4, you can't burn a bootable disk from that anymore.
Oh, interesting. Oh, that's too bad.
I will not identify the birdie because it's certainly not me.
Right. Interesting.
It's a birdie.
Yeah. Huh. That's too bad. I hope.
No, there are numerous. There are numerous reports that I've seen on the internet. So I'm not giving anything away, which basically say, whoops, that burn into the DVD or DVD thing doesn't work on a DP4, which is probably the last DP because I mean, they're releasing it next month, right?
That's what they say. Although they did do it over the air or software update for DP4 that fixed a lot of stability things.
Ah, yes. A little birdie told me about that too.
Yeah. So, it could be that developer preview 4 is the last one that we'll see. Although, those over the air or software updates make, the last one was what, 700 megs. So, I mean, it's a pretty substantial change to the OS. All right. Do we have time for one cool stuff found? Kind of. All right.
Well, not another question.
Cool. We're done with questions. We're at the hour mark here. We can't let these things go 90 minutes on our poor listeners. So
I'll let you pick.
Phoenix and everybody else has written in either telling us or asking us about an app, an iPad and iPhone. It's a universal iOS app called Downcast. And for those of you that want to download podcasts and save them on your iOS devices, this is another one in that category. And people seem to really like it. It will work with both the regular feed as well as the premium feed. If you plug the premium feed into it, you've got to go to the website and copy that feed URL because it's not in their directory, obviously. And then it'll ask you for a username and password and you type, your username and password in for premium and then it should work just fine. But, everybody seems to be talking about this thing. So it'll let you, it's not streaming. It just pulls it down. Then you play it once it's finished downloading. So you got to make sure you run a fat pipe or you plan ahead. But people seem to like Downcast. So I figured I'd throw that out there. It's, I think it's $1.99. off the top of my head, but don't quote me on that. You can quote me on it. I think it's right. So, and if I'm wrong, then pay the difference. All right. That's it. That's that one. I think that's as good as we get. You can contact us. Email feedback@macgeekgab.com.
I wholeheartedly agree with you, Dave. It is feedback@macgeekgab.com.
feedback@macgeekgab.com. You can also call us at 20666-GEEK, emphasis on the geek, which is...
I think you meant 666-GEEK, right?
Didn't I say 20666-GEEK?
I thought you dropped a 6.
Oh, I might have. You might have. There's 4 6s.
206-666-GEEK, which is 4-3-3-5.
You can Skype us to MacGeekGab. You can find us on Twitter. Twitter.com/MacGeekGab is the show. /John F. Braun is that guy there. /Pilot Pete is this guy over here. /Dave Hamilton is me. And you can find us on Facebook. Facebook.com/MacGeekGab. We'd like to throw a big thanks out to Michael Johnston of the We Have Communicators, formerly iPhone Alley podcast, for converting this show into AAC and enhancing it for you. Cashfly.com provides all the bandwidth. The podcast marketplace includes the A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, Yojimbo from Barebone Software, PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro from Smile Software, Notebook from Circus Ponies, Stitcher with promo code MGG, and Drobo with their Drobo and Drobo FS and Drobo Pro and all that other great stuff they've got going on there, all through Backbeat Media. That's it, John. We're out of here until Thursday when we will be coming to you MacGeekGab Premium, $338, $25, 6 months, 2 extra episodes a month, and supporting your 2 favorite geeks.
What a deal.
Doesn't get any better than that.
And I am going to quote you. It was $1.99.
$1.99. All right. Don't get caught.